Last week we saw a very underappreciated, extravagant act of worship, underappreciated by people who should have known better, really unappreciated by the disciples. Mary and Jesus were the only ones that really understood that when she sacrificed that alabaster jar filled with nard that was worth its weight in the equivalent weight in gold, that she was throwing away her future security, her safety net. One act of worship. I find it interesting that God, how long does God tell people something and then wait for them to get it? Well, in today's passage, we're going to see something that God for hundreds of years, once a year as a celebration, had people remembering at Passover the sprinkling of the blood of the Lamb on the doorposts of their homes and the death angel passing over and remembering God's faithfulness getting them out of Egypt after 430 years of belly aching. God stated his faithfulness, but all of those hundreds of years that the Passover celebration happened, it was also a foreshadowing of something that was going to happen in their future, where God himself was going to be the sacrifice to pay for their sins once and for all. The disciples had spent every year of their lives, it was a requirement. All Jews were supposed to come to Jerusalem, no matter where you lived, at Passover time. And Passover was kind of the kickoff of a week-long celebration called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And during that time, they had a certain little ritual, and a certain person would be in charge of the Passover meal. And the person in charge got to pick who sat where. And they had a little ritual that they went, certain elements of food that they ate. People who study such things have shown that every single element of the Passover meal had a double meaning. I mean, they were to make paste to eat with their lamb, but the paste originally was to remind them of the mud that they were forced to make bricks out of to build Egyptian cities and monuments. And all those pictures were pointing to something. Hundreds and hundreds of years. Jesus' own life, 33 Passovers. This is the last one. But all of those hundreds of years were pointing to this particular day in all of human history and the events that were unfolding. And he was the only one who understood that. So keep that in mind. I wrote a little note to myself. It's sort of a rabbit trail. It's sort of a warm-up preparatory rabbit trail. That there is a great danger in religious ritual and routine. And it's not the failing in the routine itself. The failing is in humans. Because we tend to forget the meanings of things and we just go through the motions. And you can be thinking about something completely different. There are churches that you don't even have to think because they got the whole program printed out for you. They tell you when to stand up, when to sit down, what to repeat. And you basically, your brain does not have to be engaged. I don't understand why people would like that, but I know that some of you have come from that sort of a situation, and the danger of religious ritual is not what it is that you're doing 100 times in a row. It's why you're doing it 100 times in a row. Are you engaged with what's going on? I tell you, when I traveled on the road 250 days a year doing music, leading people in worship, I had to force myself every single time with every single song. Because the thing about music is it can get stuck in your head, and you can think about something else and still sing every note and every word. I had to force myself to be real, to make it real, because as far as worship is concerned, there's somebody who's listening, and he takes it seriously. So while we're going through this ritual, probably any of us that grew up in a church are, you may have had a different way of doing it than what we did here, but the elements are basically the same, built around the skeletal structure of the events that all of the Gospels cover. Matthew 26, Luke 22, John 13, and here Mark 14. And then Paul, the apostle who came later, who didn't get to witness the events, he also records in 1 Corinthians 11. And he said he received it from an eyewitness, Jesus himself. But I hope that we're looking at... I find things every time I go through this, and once again, it does kind of bother me that it wasn't until I was in my 40s that I ever heard anybody point out some of these things. I especially think it's important over the next couple of Sundays, which cover a matter of hours in the timeline, watch how Jesus treats Judas. It might blow your mind. In today's episode, if you were to sit and diagram a chart looking at all four Gospels and diagram the account, you'd see that Jesus, the person who was in charge of this particular Passover meal, had John sitting on his right, and he had Judas sitting in the seat of honor on his left. And Jesus, being the one in charge, was the one who put everybody where they were. Please disregard Leonardo da Vinci. Please just wipe that picture out of your mind of that whole painting of the Last Supper. First of all, they weren't sitting in chairs. It says really clearly in here they were reclining, like we did at Abraham's tent, those of you that went to Israel. You'll never forget that meal because of how hard it was to swallow your food and to stand up again because we're not used to laying down. The seating is really important. Watch everything that happens. You might find yourself loving Jesus even more than you do. Let's begin reading at verse 12 in Mark's account. I am going to read one scripture from Luke. It tells us the frame of mind that Jesus was in, along with Psalm 118 that Jimmy read today. On the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb, Jesus' disciples asked him, "Where do you want us to go and make preparations for you to eat Passover?" And so he sent two of his disciples, the other Gospels tell us it was Peter and John, telling them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you." Circle the word man. Men did not carry water jars. It was considered women's work. No self-respecting man would. So he would stand out. Man carrying water jar will meet you. Follow him. And say to the owner of the house that he enters, "The teacher asks, where is my guest room, where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?" See, I always picture, maybe it's just because I grew up on television, but I always hear the music of Mission Impossible going on in the background. Dun, 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 dun. No, 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 no. And Jesus is saying, "You'll see the guy carrying the water. Okay, follow him. When he gets there, say this." And it's all like some finely oiled machine. He'll show you a large upper room, furnished and ready. Na 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 na. Make preparations for us there. The disciples left, went into the city, and found things exactly as Jesus had told them. And so they prepared the Passover. When evening came, Jesus arrived with the 12. And while they were reclining at the table, sorry, Leonardo, while they were, it wouldn't have made as good of a picture, really, if they'd had all been reclining in Leonardo's picture. While they were reclining at the table eating, he said, "I tell you the truth, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me." And the emphasis is on that word eating, and there would have been a gasp that someone would have the nerve to betray Jesus and eat with him. We'll talk about that in a minute. They were saddened, and the word is to feel sorrow inwardly. And one, I find this so pathetically real. "And one by one they said to him, 'Surely not I,'" or another way of saying is, "I'm not the one, am I?" "It is one of the 12, he replied, "one who dips bread into the bowl with me." One that is now. It's a little bit more punctiliar in Greek. "One, the one dipping with me now." Look at all four of the gospel accounts and you'll see that at this moment, Jesus hands a morsel of food to Judas. Those of you, I was hoping Garth and Holly would be here, because those who did have done Passover, and according to the Jewish custom, that's the way of honoring the person sitting in the seat of honor, is to let them be the first one that has the morsel of food handed to them. And it's specifically chosen which morsel and who it's given to, and it's an action of honor. And John is the one that tells us Jesus handed us to Judas. Somewhere in these few verses, it says, verse 21 again, "The Son of Man will go just as it's written about him. But woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man." Circle the word woe. It's not a curse. I've heard it said that way. But it's an expression of grief. It's the language of love. "Woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born." Notice Jesus didn't say, "It would be better for me if he hadn't been born," or, "I'm sorry that guy was ever born." No, it's an expression of sorrow and grief. While they were eating, Jesus took unleavened bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take it. This is my body." Luke, once again, as I said earlier, Luke says, "This is my body given for you." And in 1 Corinthians, Paul's account, he said, "This is my body broken for you." And then he took the cup, and he gave thanks, and he offered it to them, and they all drank from it. We're too conscious of how unsanitary that would be. And we don't use real wine, just sort of grape juice. So I guess if you use real wine, maybe the germs would be killed by the alcohol. I don't know, but very few churches did they all take one cup. So that's the correct historical picture. The cup. There were four cups in the Passover meal, by the way. Most scholars think that this was the third one in the sequence of events of that routine and ritual. And this one is, if it was the third one, was called the cup of blessing. "This is my blood, or the blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for many." Luke says, "For you." Matthew says, "Poured out for the forgiveness of sins." And he said to them, "I tell you the truth, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it anew in the kingdom of God." I'm looking forward to that day. The marriage supper of the Lamb, very first thing we're going to do when we get there is we're going to party down. And I've already promised the first dance after the huppah, which is the celebration. I've already promised the first dance to Patricia. And the second dance is to my grandma. And that ought to be interesting to see a Pentecostal Quaker lady and a guy who's, you know, never danced in his entire life, see them dancing together. That's you might want to be there just for that. Bring a camera. But Jesus said, I'm going to drink a new quality of wine in the kingdom, and this is the last one with you guys. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Next week we'll pick up the narrative from there. So let's look at the details in this. I didn't read you the scripture from Luke. It happens back up when the evening festivities have started, and they all arrive in the evening at the place where preparations have been made. Jesus says in Luke 15:22-15, it says, I have eagerly desired to eat this particular Passover with you. We've seen, as we've looked all the way through the Gospels, that Jesus and the disciples just never seemed to be on the same page. They had a very, very different idea of what was going to go down, despite the fact that he told them over and over what God's agenda was and God's plan. You know how it is when we obsess on things? It's hard for even God to get through. When God has a different idea than we do, this is why anytime... We've been talking about this a lot. Some of us, our whole lives have been so disrupted that we're afraid to take a step without listening to the Lord. And I'm thinking, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. I don't know where the plot line's going from here. Well, you know what? God does. I think the danger is when we think we do know what the plot line is. We don't listen, do we? We don't listen as hard. Jesus, I think at last count, he has said seven times how it was all going to go down. They didn't get it. The only person we saw last week who apparently believed him that he was actually going to die and be buried was Mary. Mike wrote me an email saying, don't you just thank God for women who listen when men are just being men? And the guys were all talking about, you know, the important stuff, you know, no, I get to be Secretary of State and I get to be Vice President. And, you know, which one of them was the greatest? And Mary was the only one really listening. Thank God for women who listen, because men don't always. We're too busy. You know what I mean? So here we are. We show up at... I'm trying to think of how in the world I could do justice to the enormity of the fact that for hundreds and hundreds of years, this particular event was foreshadowed in that yearly Passover meal. And nobody but Jesus seemed to understand the significance of this one day. That is the danger of ritual, isn't it? God may want to be doing something really special. Ritual is not a bad thing, but it's just too easy, like I said earlier, to be disengaged from it. Just go through the motions. And you never know what day God wants to change your whole life. You never know what day on God's particular calendar events that have you've gone on your whole life have been pointing to this particular day. And I always have that in my mind when I look at this, that they didn't understand it. They did later. It's interesting that they went from having the Passover meal, which then they called the Lord's Supper after the resurrection, they went from having that once a year to the church in the book of Acts in Jerusalem did it, some people have said, every time they met together. You know, sort of making up for lost time when you realize you've totally blew it because you were just going through the ritual, you're going through the church motions, and you had no idea how significant it was. And then once you see, could you could you do it? Could you do the little piece of cracker after you watch Jesus's body being ripped to shreds? And just do that lightly and realize he said, this little cracker that you're going to take every time you do this, it represents my body given to you, broken for you. Could you ever do that again after you witnessed that? Remember the scene in, it's startlingly authentic portrayal in The Passion of the Christ. The scene where he's being whipped by that Roman instrument of torment and the entire courtyard is covered with blood. Could you take your little thing of grape juice ever again after you saw this person that you loved have their body ripped and blood flying everywhere? Could you ever do that again? Wouldn't you want to make up for lost time? Wouldn't you want to just do it over and over and over? I get it, Lord. I understand why you did this. You did this because you love me. That's why over and over in this sequence of events, some of the narratives, Mark doesn't cover it, but some of the other narratives say, after he took the bread and after he explained what that was to represent in the cup and what that was to represent, he said, whenever you do this from now on, remember me. Don't remember the Passover lamb. Don't just go through the motions. Remember me, the living, breathing Jesus. Singing that song, this is the day the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. I don't know, startling to me. The juxtaposition of the humans going through the motions and the one it's all been talking about. Have you ever had a song just hit you? You've sung it 100 times or you've heard it 100 times and then on one particular day it just hits you between the eyes and goes right straight into your heart and you it engages in a place. It's like cogs in the machinery that just click into place and you can almost visibly see that happen. I've had that happen. That's what Luke 22:15 is talking about when Jesus said, I have earnestly desired for this particular Passover meal to be celebrated with you. It wasn't the first one. He'd celebrated with them. There seems to be some debate amongst Bible scholars as to how many Passovers Jesus was in Jerusalem with his followers. And I'm not going to debate that. I would, by my count, this is the third or fourth one. It was the last one, at any rate. And he was looking forward to, because there was going to be a fulfillment of something that all their whole entire lives nobody really saw, and everything would be changed from that point on. So the danger of ritual and routine is that we can miss the meaning. And the other danger of ritual and routine is that God might want to do something right now, right here, life-altering. God might have looked forward to this day and these words your whole life. And you know how it is. I mean, I have to teach the word, but I wasn't always a teacher. I remember your brain could be somewhere completely different. Your brain could be home, you know. Did I turn the oven on? Are we going to get home and find raw meat instead of a roast? You know, and, you know, thinking about, you know, I got to bleed the brakes on my car. I forgot to do it yesterday, or it was rain. You know, all those things our brains can be engaged with and miss the living God. In this place, looking me in the eyes, having something to say to me. That is the danger of religious ritual and religious routine, is not from God's perspective. It's not the words that are spoken. It's just me and how distractible I am. On the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb, The disciples said, no doubt they'd send it at least a couple of times. Okay, here we are. You're going to be the one in charge. We'll go make the preparations. Any specific place that you have in mind? Just give us the go-ahead and we'll go get things ready. Once again, this is a ho-hum kind of thing. Yeah, we waited all year. Here we are. Nothing kind of worked out exactly the way we thought. You know, everybody's waving the palm branches and say, save us now, Hoshiana. And we're thinking we're going to march right into Antonia Fortress and kick out all the Romans. Everything is going to be groovy. And it just isn't going down that way. That's okay. At least we have Passover. Okay, let's get this over with. And here's this one person saying, no, this is all the focal point of human history. Past and present and future is going to this point in time. And he's the only one that seemed to get it. So he sent two of his disciples. The other Gospels, as I pointed out, said it was Peter and John. And he said, go into the city, and you see a man carrying a water jar. They would notice. Men didn't carry water jars. Follow him. Once again, I can't get the Mission Impossible theme out of my head because everything has already been in sequential order. You walk into the city, remember once again, how many people were there in Jerusalem for these feasts? Josephus says 2.5 million people. I can't wrap my brain around that. Those of us that walked the wall, and we walked around the wall, remember on that free day that we had, can you imagine 2.5 million people squeezed into there? And all of them want falafels at the same time that you do. And I mean, it would have been a nightmare. So what would stand out? Well, a guy carrying a water jar would stand out. So Jesus sends them into this teeming mass and turmoil of people. You know, all the gawkers and the Passover equivalent of leaf peepers, you know, people who aren't watching where they're going because they're looking at the scenery. All of those people, plus the people who had stuff to do. He said, just, okay, here's your mission. Find a guy carrying a water jar. That should be easy. He's going to stand out and follow him. Notice the language here. He said, when you go to the owner of the house that this man carrying the water jar enters, here's what you say to him. The teacher asked, how many teachers were there in Jerusalem at this particular time? I would have left the kind of a detail that my inquiring mind would want to know. I didn't look it up. But even when it wasn't Passover, there were hundreds of rabbis. The teacher, where is my guest room? And he'll show a large upper room furnished and ready. So that implies, all of that implies that there had to have been previous preparations made. I just have one little rabbit trail. It's not a big one. I think the principle is enormously important. And that is the value of faithfulness. It's weird in a little church. In a big church, it's not so much of a big deal because there are so many people. But in a little church like ours, if one person doesn't show up or one person doesn't do the thing that, there's just not a lot of backups. Faithfulness is such an important thing. And I look at, you know, what if the homeowner had, what if it had slipped his mind? Oh, darn, I was supposed to have that place ready. Or the guy carrying the water jar said, I'm not carrying no stinking water jar, not in public. I might as well wear a skirt. You know, I'm a man. I am not going to carry that water jar. What if Peter and John just said, hey, let's just find a place. There's too many people. I'm a country boy. I just can't stand it. rush of people. Just let's just find something. What if anybody didn't do the part, the simple part that they had? We talked about this, I think, a Wednesday or two ago, and I used the example of orchestrations. Having been a person that wrote orchestrations for many, many years, and then hired some of the very best people in the country, you know, professional studio people to play those parts, it was very important that they played the parts that I wrote. If the French horn player said, you know, I am tired of counting measures. This is the best French horn that the French horn builders ever made. I'm just going to start playing. I don't feel like waiting till the end. I'll just start playing my part right now. The whole thing would be pandemonium. There's a quote that Beethoven said once in terms of composition, that the notes are silver and the rests are gold. Meaning that what you don't play is just as important as what you do play. Of course, that stands out in my mind, having done that for a living for many years. The example that the Apostle Paul used is a body. Suppose that the pointer finger got personally offended by something that one of the eyeballs did and decided that at any given opportunity it was going to try to poke that eyeball. Remember Get Smart? Remember the guy with the mechanical hand that tried to kill him all the time? So he couldn't turn his back on his own hand, or it would, next thing you know, it would be going like this and it would, you know, grab him and try to strangle him. What if part of the body just got so ticked off at another part of the body that it's decided one eye got mad at the other eye and said, that's it, I am not tracking with you. And your eyes decided to look different directions. Your feet decided to go different. It's humorous, and of course we know it's not the way it was designed. Satan's so good at what he does. You know why the gates of hell are prevailing against the church? Whenever they are, it's because of that one principle. We're divided. Faithfulness to what the designer designed, to hearing from him. We don't have to be the same. The body is made up of a lot of different parts. Just like that orchestra made up of a lot of different instruments, the important thing for the body is hear what the head is telling you to do, do that. And then the body works fine. So I look at this, that's my little rabbit trail. I look at this whole thing and seeing what could have been missed just because one guy said, oh, that's beneath me, I'm not going to carry a water jar. Or I don't feel good today, I don't think I'll show up. You know what I mean? What they could have missed being part of. What part of the whole plan could have crumbled simply because this person's presence was important. Pastors are expected to say stuff like that. But it's the truth. So here's a couple of guys that fit strategically into the whole plan, who didn't really appear to be doing very religious things. But when the disciples followed Jesus' instructions, I love what it says. It says, they left and went into the city and found things exactly like Jesus had told them. So here's where Luke 22:15 fits in, right before verse 17 of our narrative. Jesus arrives with the 12, and he looks at them and he says, I have eagerly, intensely, the Amplified Bible says, desire to eat this Passover with you. The emphasis is on this particular Passover. I looked up the word desire, the verb in the sentence, if there's anybody out in the lobby writing these things down. or in here, the if you're interested, the verb is the verb epithumeo, E-P-I-T-H-U-M-E-O. One translation, I think the Amplified Bible says longed for intensely, celebrating this Passover with you. It's the exact opposite of dread. Now remember, Jesus knows everything that's about to happen. He knew it in Gethsemane, we're going to see in a week or two, to just the thinking ahead caused the blood vessels on the surface of the skin to erupt, and he sweat drops of blood out of sheer agony in anticipation. So if he'd said, I have dreaded this Passover ever since I've been here, that would be really understandable, wouldn't it? For him to say, I have wanted to do this ever since I met you guys. That just tells us that, once again, I've just had the wrong picture of this whole event for so much of my life. And there were lots of scriptures that talked about the joy. Lots of scriptures, even the ones in the Hallel Psalms, that talk about, I'm going to rejoice and be glad because this is God's plan that's unfolding. And I missed it all. And simply, a lot of it was because just of the morbid sort of drudgery that the whole picture was presented. Does it mean that you shouldn't be serious? No. Nobody was more dead serious about this than Jesus was. But he knew there was a picture being painted. And for the first time when he explained what was going to go down, their brains couldn't have grasped it. What does he mean, broken body? What does he mean, body given? What does he mean, blood signing a new contract? What does he mean? They had no idea. In a few hours, they would. For the rest of their lives, they would.